You're listening to the Functional Nerds Podcast with your hosts, Patrick Hester and Tracy Townsend.
Welcome back, friends. Please make sure your pod seats and tray tables are in their upright and locked position. The airlock has been sealed and docking clamps have been released for an on-time departure to the Functional Nerdverse. I came so dangerously close to messing it up again, didn't I, there? In my defense, I had, before we actually got started recording, our guest very, very gamely ushered his cat out of his study to be able to record in privacy. I don't have the option of that because I record in the basement, which is the domain of the cats, and one of them was nesting on my feet down here, and I was just trying to make sure I wasn't going to get stabbed and almost missed giving you the cue on the music again. Wow, I'm batting 1,000 here and not in the good baseball sense.
Yeah. Good times.
Well, okay. I guess baseball fantasies are better than football fantasies at this point, particularly if you're a Browns fan like Todd.
Hey, that's my shtick. You don't get to mess with Todd on Browns.
Okay, all right. I won't horn in on your teasing Todd territory about sports and stuff. So on the subject of territories, though, and kind of shifting territory a little bit here, our guest for this episode is Daniel H. Wilson, whose Hole in the Sky, which came out in October, I think is a really interesting reinterpretation and revisiting of the territory of first contact here. So, Daniel, welcome aboard. Talk to us about the premise for Hole in the Sky.
Hey, Patrick and Tracy. Thanks for having me. Hole in the Sky is a story of first contact with an alien entity. It takes place in northeastern Oklahoma, where I'm from, near Spiro Mounds. And it starts with the detection of an interstellar anomaly that approaches Earth. And then, things take a left turn as this thing sort of lands near Spiro. And it's kind of told through the perspective of a by-the-book CIA weapons expert and a NASA astrophysicist, and then just a dude who lives in Oklahoma, a native guy, Cherokee guy, who lives in a single-wide trailer out there, who is sort of mourning the loss of had some family trauma and is reuniting with his teenage daughter when this all goes down. And yeah, I wanted to kind of approach this sort of genre story of first contact, right? Which we all love. It's like the alien invasion stuff. But kind of, tell it through these three very different perspectives, and these three characters kind of have really different postures towards the unknown, you know? And so to get that native perspective in there was pretty fun. I'm a Cherokee citizen. That's where I grew up, is out there. So I got a lot of my childhood in there, but I've also been a scientist, and I've also done some random contract work for the United States Air Force. So this was really fun just to throw everything in to this first contact story.
Very cool.
I love that there's like so many different threads from your own life experience that you're able to kind of draw from here. So when you say that you're from within the Cherokee Nation, did you grow up on the res?
So Oklahoma is an interesting place. Thinking about tribes, it's very different than I think what most people think about whenever they think about tribal nations. So Oklahoma was Indian country, right? It was Indian territory, and they force marched five tribes out there, including the Cherokee and the Creek and Choctaw, Chickasaw, Seminole. So all those tribes are out there. And then, of course, they decided to take the land away again and make it into Oklahoma. And so what kind of happened was those tribes all have sovereign territory. So it overlays right on top of the state of Oklahoma. And the tribes have state-level jurisdiction, which means, you know, a state can do a lot of stuff, but it can't print money and it can't declare war. Those are the main things. So the tribes can't do that either. But if you know, I grew up in North Tulsa, which is Tulsa is just a city, right? I mean, it's just Tulsa. But the north part of Tulsa is within the Cherokee Nation and technically the Cherokee Reservation. South Tulsa is Creek Nation, right? If you go east, it's the Choctaw Nation. And so if you go north, it's the Osage Nation. So I, for instance, if I lived in Oklahoma, which I don't, I live in Portland, Oregon. But my dad, all my family's still there, and they have Cherokee license plates and Cherokee hospitals and Cherokee driver's license, Cherokee police. They really replicate a lot of the state level function for their citizens. And so, Yes. The answer, short answer is yes. I grew up on a Cherokee reservation, but no, it is not what people imagine when they think about the poverty porn that they see related to reservations.
Fun fact, if you're driving on certain roads and in one area you're in the United States and you're speeding, you can get a ticket. If you then cross over into the res on the same road and you're speeding, you can get a separate ticket. And that's so much fun.
What happened to you? Is this a personal story?
I will say this. Oklahoma, if you're driving on I-40 and you're going through Oklahoma, Oklahoma lasts forever.
If you're going east-west, you know it can take a minute, but drive through Texas and then talk to me about forever. Oh, no,
I did that because I went from California to Tennessee. So I did I-40, you know, through the panhandle, through Oklahoma, through all of that. It was a lot.
Yeah, it's a lot. I mean, it's I think it's beautiful. You know, Oklahoma is very green. It's these rolling hills. And this is the panhandle is pretty rough. That's pretty rough. Yeah. That's like desert. But out where I'm from, it's green country, right? And so it's just you can see to the horizon and it's these rolling green fields. And you can just see like the shadows of the clouds. And that's where Spiro is at. So Spiro is a cool place to pick because it's the westernmost ruins of the mound builder civilization. So they were all over eastern United States for like, you know, that tens of thousands of years before all the tribes that we know today. And so all these mounds were everywhere and they're mostly gone because everybody built cities right on top of them because they just happened to be laid out in the absolute best place to build cities. They'd be near water, they'd be defensible, they'd be near crops and, you know, and so that civilization kind of had it figured out. And to the extent that, you know, when colonizers were settling new cities, they would be like, oh, there's mounds here. This is great. This is going to be a great place to build a city. But my family's Indian allotment, like the first, after forced removal, the land that we got, I spent all my summers out there and it's like a couple of miles from Spiro. And so it's always been this really cool, mysterious, ancient place. One fun fact is that the Spiro mounds are laid out in the pattern of the Pleiades constellation. And there's all these old oral traditions through the Cherokee who are, you know, the Cherokee are from in Georgia, but like even in Spiro, the mound builder civilization, which predated the Cherokee, they, you know, they also had all these stories and artifacts and things related to looking up at the stars and looking at and imagining who's up there and who might come here.
That's very cool.
So when you're talking a moment ago about the kind of like the interaction of different people with the space, like the colonizing force of the various groups that pushed westward and oftentimes pushed native groups with them or away from them in the course of doing that, I'm thinking also about that first contact piece here, because I think there's something intrinsic in the interaction of Western settlers in American history with the native people here that functionally kind of is a first contact story.
Yeah.
And
a
in that
first
sense,
contact horror story for the native peoples
in many respects. But I think that not all first contact stories become colonizing stories. And so I think many of them do. And so I'm kind of curious about thinking about first contact where native people play a role in it and are present for it and have this very different experience of first contact from their own kind of cultural memory. Like, what role do you think that colonization plays in your book for along with first contact?
Yeah, well, first of all, it's just there in our expectations. I mean, this is what I like to do. I feel like I could have just written 10 Robopocalypse books and, you know, sold a ton more books than I've sold, but that's just so boring, right? Like, what I like to do is I love genre. I love robot uprisings and I love alien invasions, but also I don't want to tell the same story over and over again, right? Like, you can write like carbon copy techno thrillers and it's just not what I want to do with my day. So, you know, in Robopocalypse, if you read closely and or the sequel too, the robots are saving humanity. And there's a bigger fight at hand. And it's all about how we can't blow up our technology and walk away from the explosion, you know, real cool, not looking back over our shoulder. Like, we have to work with technology in order to survive in this civilization. So with this, I wanted to do the same thing. I wanted to like approach an established genre and kind of give it, you know, subvert it a little bit and give it a new sort of perspective. And obviously that includes like the fact that almost every alien invasion story, the aliens show up to Earth. They want to extract our resources and take our land and water. And they sometimes want to enslave us. They often want to destroy our culture. You know, in Independence Day, they blew up. He blew up all of our monuments, the bastards. And that's pretty clearly, you know, a thinly veiled fear projection that the aliens are going to show up and do to this civilization what colonizers have done to indigenous people. And so part of what, you know, I was thinking about with that is obviously what would a native perspective be on that? And then also just like, why do we expect that? You know, why do we expect that they would almost always show up and attack us or take our stuff? And I think a lot of that is because we're looking out into the cosmos and we're sort of seeing a reflection of ourselves. Like, what would we do? And it was pretty clear what humans are capable of in that respect. And so what I wanted to do was I wanted to set up the story with that kind of stuff. I love that. You know, the novel I wrote before this was a sequel to The Andromeda Strain. I mean, it doesn't get more techno thriller than that, right? So the Crichton, you know, created the genre. So with that, I wanted to start out techno thriller, and then I wanted to pull it more toward an experience that can't be sort of where there's no framework in a Western mindset to understand what it is. And it's going to make my native character more important because he has these cultures and traditions that just happen to allow him to have a better understanding of what this entity might be and how to survive it. And so in the end, it really becomes all three of these characters are very important for what happens and how, you know, how we get to an ending, not necessarily a happy ending. It all depends on your perspective on that. But so that was kind of my goal there was to jump into a genre I love and then subvert it a little bit and give people maybe a unique take on what that could be.
Very cool.
I love a good subversion, and but I think we can only like really appreciate a subversion as something more than just like I'm going to be playful with this material for its own sake if we kind of understand the ideas that are driving the choice to subvert, right? So at the risk of being crazily and maybe problematically reductionist here, you mentioned before like that Western point of view being taken into the first contact story and alien encounters, that kind of mirror of are we telling on ourselves when we first thing we think is conquest, right? Mm-hmm. And so if we're thinking that there's such a thing as a native point of view versus a Western point of view, I think that that's something that a lot of listeners might not understand how to distinguish between them, right? Sure. And so can we be so bold as to pick a thing that Westerners typically have a recurring point of view on that Native people fundamentally view in a different kind of way?
Well, I mean, I can speak for being Cherokee. I can't speak obviously for every Native person or every Cherokee or anything like that. But I am, so you know, I started out getting a degree in robotics. And I mean, I was like, I spent a lot of time in academia building robots and basements and very much a scientist, and then I obviously science fiction is better than science, so I did that, you know, when I had the opportunity, but a lot less going to work, at least. But so for this, I mean, really, to set a, sort of aside this idea of that there is a native perspective or some kind of pan-Indian thing, which is not true. I really got focused on the idea of indigenous technology and like, what's the difference between sort of like Western science and advanced indigenous technologies that are out there. And that's really how I wanted to frame the understanding of the entity, right? I wanted it to be a tool that you can't understand how to use it from a Western perspective and that you could have some framework for understanding with a more indigenous approach. So like, you know, just to dive in, I mean, so, you know, when colonists showed up in North America, they looked out at the woods where they were, and it's often described as a Garden of Eden. So they were looking at where the native people were living. And they described it as like sort of a God-given, like such a beautiful place, perfect for human habitation, with these primitive people living there, these lucky savages, you know, who just happened to be occupying God's country here. And of course, what they didn't know and couldn't see was that there were advanced agroforestry techniques that have been in place for like thousands of years, right? And so this really grabbed me thinking about this, because I was realizing, you know, any sufficiently advanced technology is indistinguishable from magic. And like these people who had, in a lot of ways, much more advanced technology than the folks they were showing up and meeting, but also couldn't even see the technology that was all around them, right? And so what is that blind spot? You know, why does that exist? And part of it, I think, I mean, it has to do with so many different things, but it's like, you know, fundamentally what science for, you know, the way our civilization is structured right now is capitalist. It's exponentially growing. It's about feeding more mouths, wringing out an extra 25% profit every month, you know, every quarter, on and on and on and on, and resource extraction, and, you know, ultimately like exterminating the planet, right? and moving on to new planets, right? That's really in science fiction.
Yeah.
Colonization is like the backbone of a lot of science fiction, space operas and stuff like that. And so all the science that we have is dedicated to that, right? So if you're going to study a plant, you take the plant out of the forest first. You kill off all those unknowns. Then you break and you remove it from the context in which it exists. And then you break it in pieces, and then you study those pieces, right? And then maybe you build some you make some medicine, or you replicate, you know, the plant thousands of times. Well, so what those native people that were living there, their goal was not to do that, right? Their goal was to sort of sustain the amount of people that they had, right? So I feel like their basic outlook with their science and their technology is fundamentally different. It's not about growth, it's about balance. And I think there's room for both things, obviously. But like, if you fundamentally are looking for something different, then your science will be expressed differently. And what's crazy is it makes it invisible, right? And so the indigenous technology is like, you know, really specific to just where it's at. They leave the plant there. They leave all those unknowns there. They're comfortable with a lot of unknowns, whereas Western science isn't. And like, ultimately, you know, it's all of their techniques are super specific to that place. It's not going to work, you know, in the Southwest or the Northwest. It's only going to work there. It's the kind of knowledge that you gain by being embodied in the same place day after day, year after year. So anyway, I started out looking at those fundamental differences, and then I cooked up sort of an alien technology that I felt like was going to be something that Western science would be blind to and unable to deal with. And so that was really where I started. Not with like, oh, native people have a connection to nature and blah, blah, blah. It was just like embodied in the environment, you know, yeah. A use case that's very specific. So that's what I was kind of going for. But it's very nerdy, and it's probably very boring to listen to. That's not really how the book goes. I'm not breaking all this stuff down in the book, you know, in that way. So
we're kind of good with nerdy around here.
Yeah, as soon as I said that, I was like, I might be in the right place.
It's the brand. Yeah.
So Patrick, while Daniel was talking there, I found myself thinking a lot about the Amy Adams flick adapted from Ted Chiang's Arrival. And I think that obviously we're looking at two different creative products in the science fictional universe here, but one of the threads that I feel like is kind of drawn together is the idea that we're trying to understand this technology, this way of thinking, this way of life by importing in our own values and expectations. And when we don't see them overlap, and we don't know how to use our own values and expectations to understand them, then we draw the conclusion that, well, this isn't science, or this is all sort of atavism or something else. And I think in the same way that like the heptapod's language and its kind of like circularity reflects their experience of the world, we develop things that reflect our experience of the world, which I guess can be kind of sobering considering the world that we're living in right now.
Yeah. Well, I think that's why I mean, first of all, obviously that's an amazing movie and an amazing short story. And every short story that Ted Chiang has ever written is like the best short story ever.
It's like, oh shit, he did it again.
I mean, he is absolutely incredible. He was. I gave a talk about this book in Seattle, and for Clarion West was there, and Ted was there. And he really doesn't believe in aliens, you know, the unidentified anomalous phenomenon and stuff. So I was, I was catcalling him from the stage, which is kind of fun. But I think that because this kind of stuff does lie outside of our understanding, you know, the little reality creation engine that's between our, you know, ears, this kind of stuff can go into cosmic horror pretty easy, like H.P. Lovecraft style stuff. Mm-hmm. That's like beyond our ken, you know, like titanic forces moving beyond the perception, beyond our perception. And I think I go there a little bit in this novel. There's stuff that's just unknowable and it's unknown and we just have to live with it, you know? And there's one character who can't live with it. He can't let it be there. It haunts him to know that there's these things that are just beyond the edge of his perception. And I would say that if you look at native religions and you look at native stories, oral traditions, you know, Cherokee in particular, before contact, before Christianity, you see that they're very comfortable with the unknown. Like the religion, I think, oh gosh, I can't remember which tribe it is, but their religion is literally called like the Great Mystery. Like they're not trying to tell you the answers, right? If you look at all those oral traditions, there's hardly ever good or evil. It's always somewhere in between. And then we call them tricksters now, like, oh, it's a trickster character. But that's just, that word doesn't even really fit. It just means that it wasn't prescriptive, right? It wasn't telling you what's good and evil and who's a hero and who's a villain. And so I think it ends up being a little more comfortable with the unknown, ultimately, those stories are, than if you're raised up saying, okay, well, yeah, but write down 10 things for me not to do on a tablet. And, I'm not going to do those things, right? Like, just give it to me straight, doc. You know, it's a little bit of a different approach. I mean, even the Cherokee language is interesting in that it's highly contextual. So like an object will have a different name based on what's around it and what's going on. Right, the object itself gets its meaning from its from where it's at in the environment and what's going on, and obviously English isn't like that. You know, you have an object, that's the object. You use the object. You know, it doesn't matter what, that's it. You know, you put a label on it and it exists independently. So, I don't know. I think all of that kind of stuff goes into. I think people are very capable of understanding the world in different ways based on their language and based on, and I know there's technical terms for all this that I'm not smart enough to have cached.
That's all very Noam Chomsky type stuff. So I mean, it's in a sense like how does our folklore shape what we think the world does and like what it's so Patrick, outside of the 10 rules on the tablet sort of thing, which we've covered many times as part of the Hester imposed folklore, is there a folklore for you that was kind of always a part of your childhood, your upbringing, your thinking about stuff?
Because there was Greek mythology.
Oh yeah.
Because that's what I learned very young. So I just always had Greek mythology in the back of my head.
Yeah, me too. And that's good stuff.
It is. Yeah. I've mentioned it before. The version that we read in school was Bullfinch.
Yeah.
So Bullfinch's mythology. And it had all the Greek stuff in there. And yeah, that was good stuff. It wasn't until I moved to Tennessee and was, in my late 20s. That I went into a used bookstore and I found Irish folklore. And I was like, hey, I'm half Irish, half hillbilly. I should check this out. And started reading that stuff too. So, and that's when I found out about
Cú Chulainn, Finn McCool.
Yeah, and all the stuff that goes into Kevin Hearn's books.
Yeah.
Druid kind of stuff. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. That's, I think there's an argument to be made that like science fiction has developed its own folklore too. And like those different folklores also attach to value systems. Like I think particularly for some of like the big flagship IPs, I think the idea that like there is the Prime Directive in Star Trek, the idea that there is like the Federation and its values and so on.
Yeah,
that's always Star Wars has the dark and the light side of the Force and so on. Like, I think it's almost this exercise. Science fiction, I think, sometimes is an exercise in trying to create the folklores that we can take from fiction into our world in some way as a method of understanding that I wouldn't say replaces religion or replaces like heritage folklore, but it, I think in many ways it can be a supplement for us for some of those things.
Yeah. I mean, that was kind of part of what also motivated me to write this book was I did this threat forecasting job where I got hired by the contract work. I'm not part of any military, but the Air Force hires science fiction authors to write threat scenarios, and they pair you with an analyst who briefs you on a technology, and then the technologies are very dry and boring on paper, right? You know, a white paper is very difficult to read, but so you write a juicy story that somebody can really understand how this technology could be used, you know, in a way that could be dangerous or whatever. And so as a result of that, I went to some security conferences and Air Force ones. They talk about unidentified anomalous phenomena and like, they're really serious about freaking UFOs, right? And so like, I was thinking like, what, you know, what happens if we actually have first contact in that way? Are people going to freak out? War of the Worlds style, like run sure. through the streets with pitchforks? And like, the answer is like, probably, right? I mean,
yeah.
We got examples of this before, like, you know, we heliocentrism, you know, realizing that everything doesn't revolve around the Earth. That was like a big pill to swallow, you know, for people at the time, because it requires completely rethinking where we're at in the universe, you know, and how important we are. And what does anything mean if suddenly we're not sort of special, right? And so that ability, that sort of mental malleability to reframe things and to be comfortable with a big change like that, like we're not alone in the universe. I think there are certain sort of cultural backgrounds that are be more comfortable with that than others, you know?
Funny that you mentioned the Air Force though, because we've had all these hearings recently, right? Because UAPs are on the Congress's radar. Yeah. And it's nice to have something completely different to focus on coming out of Congress, right?
Sure.
And the one branch that refuses to cooperate or be involved with anything that they're doing is the Air Force.
Yeah, I guess that they've got kind of their own, they're having to deal with it. They're the ones that have to deal with it, right? So I'm not sure. Yeah.
It's funny. And then on top of that, like they still refuse to admit that the Stargate is in Cheyenne Mountain in Colorado Springs.
Yeah. Did you see that Amazon is restarting the Stargate?
I did see that. Yeah.
Good move out of Amazon.
A local author that I've known forever, Kevin Eikenberry, was former Army, but he was, for some reason, he was stationed in Cheyenne Mountain for something. And the thing that like the shtick that I always use with him is, can you confirm or deny that the Stargate existed in the Cheyenne Mountain? He's like, I cannot. I can neither confirm nor deny. Like,
are you in Colorado? Are you near Colorado Springs?
I am. Yes, I'm about 45 minutes to an hour, depending on who's driving.
Okay. Well, good luck in World War III.
Yeah, we also had Space Command, but I guess that's getting moved.
NORAD and NORTHCOM are right over there, huh? Oh, yep. No, did they move it? Well, they moved it out of Cheyenne Mountain and into Pearson, right?
But we still have Cheyenne Mountain. We still have the Air Force Academy here. Yeah. We have lots of Air Force bases here. So, yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, that's – I mean, it's just – honestly, I was just like, I was talking to the general, the guy that at the time, his name was Glenn Van Herk, and this is like 4 or 5 years ago. He was in charge of NORTHCOM and NORAD, and I was just like, and he's talking about these UAPs and what their responses are and what they think it is and what they don't think it is, mostly what they don't think it is. And then I was just like, stay in your lane, dude. This is science fiction. why are you talking about this? It's when science and science fiction are overlapping in that way. It's just like, what? It's a wild situation.
What I find interesting, if we're going to go down the UAP UFO path.
Rabbit hole. Yeah.
Is how many, like, I want to say, like, Native American sites tend to have, in the mythology of UAPs and UFOs, tend to be sites where there's a lot of activity.
Yeah, isn't that interesting? So,
it is.
So
again, you did mention also the coordination with the Pleiades astronomical event, though. So I don't know.
Definitely. I dove into that with this. So I got some of my favorite Cherokee stories. I got versions of them that I kind of am working into the hole in the sky. In particular, I mean, there's the origin story, sort of the foundational oral tradition for the Cherokee people. Where do we come from? Is that we came from the Pleiades, from the constellation, so called the Seven Sisters, you know. Mm-hmm. And the idea, it's the Star Woman cosmology or mythology, says that Star Woman brought Cherokee people to the earth. She opened up and we came out of her. And then she went up into the sky and changed names to the Dark One and went behind a veil. And is still up there, but we just can't see her. And like, that's like the foundational story for Cherokee people. That's some good science fiction, right?
Yeah.
So,
indigenous, but from space.
Yeah. I mean, Indians in space. I mean, that's another thing I really like. I mean, I'm writing science fiction. I'm just writing about where I'm from. It's not, you know, whatever. Stephen King's from Maine. He writes a lot of stuff in Maine. I'm from Oklahoma. I write, there's a bunch of Native people in what I write because that's what's in Oklahoma, right? Nobody ever like said, let's write Indians and robots and aliens. That's what's going to sell, you know? But I do love that I'm writing science fiction. And when people think of Native people, they almost always think of the past and history and stuff. And so stuff like Indians in space, man, I love that, right? Because it's like, no, we're gonna tell a story in the future about, you know, people who've been relegated to the past largely. And so that's one thing that tickles me a lot. I enjoy putting Native people in space or putting them, having them fight robots and put them in the future.
Yeah, it's good stuff.
Well, it's a chance to define yourselves and to, you know, to lay hold of some territory in this imaginative space and say like, no, like we have a role to play in it too. I mean, particularly in a world where it seems increasingly as if like, we're surrounded by people who keep wanting to redefine who gets to belong and like where mm-hmm. they belong, like in sometimes extremely literal political territorial sense. I remember reading an article recently about a couple members of the Hopi Nation in Arizona and a couple of Navajo who were detained by ICE. And they were like, we want to deport you. And they're like, have fun with that. Take me to Tuba City. How about like deport me to Tuba? And that's about as far as it's going to go. But I think that there's a lot of, I mean, that desire to place yourself and people who you've known and people like the people you've known into the future that you can imagine is totally natural. And it's
Well, I mean, I think it's part of the renaissance of science fiction right now, too. You know, Afrofuturism and just like seeing genre through a new cultural perspective is fun. I mean, I dig it. I've been reading so much and it's like, it's fun. I mean, the fact is sort of we love these stories for a reason, right? Genre, science fiction, horror, like, I mean, it's so much fun. And so to have somebody dive into a different culture's mythologies and monsters and like and dreams and prophecies. I mean, it's just more good stuff. So so I love it. I mean, I love reading it and I love writing it too. But yeah, there is a lot. There's, you know, a lot of focus on community. And it is nice. I mean, Oklahoma is interesting like that. There's a big fight, of course, going on between the governor, who is realizing that the tribes are doing well, you know, for their citizens, and it's making the state look bad. And so there's a renewed effort to sort of take everything away again. You know, like that, sympathy for Native people turn curdles very quickly once they start doing well. And so that's what's happening in Oklahoma. And again, it's just, it's great. I've written short stories that play around with this stuff, and it's just fascinating. And science fiction is a great way to break into it and sort of tell these stories in a way that's interesting and also lets you sort of get at what's going on without, you know, without writing a documentary.
But, well, Patrick's a good person to sell a documentary to, so he might be down for that as well. So
yeah, I do a lot of documentaries, don't I?
On that note, and maybe even anticipating where you're going, because you're pretty good at these things, Patrick. I think picks of the week.
It is time for picks of the week. We'll get to picks of the week in just a second. I wanted to take a moment to say it's been 3 years. 3 years since anyone has given us a star or a review on Apple Podcasts. And that's just insane. So, if you like what we do, please take a couple of minutes. Go over to Apple Podcasts and give us a star and maybe some kind of kind words, like a review. And if you don't use Apple Podcasts, no worries. Take those same couple of minutes to give us a star and some kind words on your favorite podcast catcher or platform, whatever that may be. It really does help. Now, back to what you really wanted to hear, picks of the week.
Is it a documentary, Patrick?
I mean, I could frame it as a documentary, a documentary about a ranger in Middle Earth who is murdered along with his family and becomes a shade trapped in Mordor.
Oh, okay.
And working with the shade of an elf trapped in Mordor.
Yeah. Okay.
And then he has to battle orcs to try to break a curse to get himself out. I mean, we could frame that as a documentary, or we could just call it a video game called Shadow of Mordor.
Okay. That works too.
This is an older game. This is my pick this week. This is an older game. I played it once on PS4, I believe, and I never finished it. It came up for sale on Steam, and I was like, you know what? I never finished that game, and it has quite literally nothing whatsoever to do with any of the books by Tolkien. I mean, it's just this is just something that
some place names here and there.
Yeah, Warner Brothers is like, hey, we have the rights to make games in the Lord of the Rings, so we're just gonna make shit up. We're just gonna go for it. And it's like a first person combat kind of game with magic, but it's set in Middle Earth, and it's this ranger dude, and he's dead, but he gets to go around killing the orcs that like killed his family and killed all the other rangers and did all this shit. And you're kind of doing this hierarchical thing where like if you kill one orc, like that means that another orc gains favor and they kind of become a new captain in the orc army. And every time they get promoted, and they fight amongst themselves as well for like station, and then they get more powerful, and then you have to take them down. And it's this weird, it's a very weirdish kind of game, but it's also kind of good. And yeah, I just wanted to play it again. So it was on sale. It was stupid cheap. I want to say it was like $5 now because it's like a 10-year-old game or something like that. But it's on Steam and I'm playing it, and it's called Shadow of Mordor. And again, if you are looking for something that is deep into the lore of Tolkien and the Lord of the Rings and the Hobbit, this is not what you are looking for.
It's like a fanfic.
Yeah, but if you just want something where you get to run around and sneak around and kill orcs and shoot them with arrows and use weird magic on them to like rip their mind, like you could rip their minds out and learn all their information. Yeah, there's like weird shit like that. So good stuff.
They had fun making that game.
They did. Yeah.
Yeah, it sounds like, yeah.
They were like, how can we turn Tolkien into like an action game with lots of blood and gore?
Yeah. Tolkien, but make it God of War.
Yeah.
All right. So Daniel, how about you? What's your pick?
You know, it's getting to be that season, you know, we're encroaching into, Xmas territory. And, so I actually just went, last night. I live in Portland, Oregon, and I went to go see Die Hard the Musical, which is like an improv group. This is not an improv. I mean, they improv a little bitty bit, but mostly it's a musical. It was at the Armory. The Funhouse Lounge people put it on. And it's massively popular around here. And it is so funny. And the guy who plays Gruber is the best. He's just like, Dio. Oh, my God. But it's
Yippee-ki-yay,
a
motherfucker.
Yippee-ki-yay. Yeah, they have a whole number, a whole musical number, obviously, on that. And the one thing they say is they say, okay, listen, we love you. We all obviously love Die Hard. Do not shout out the lines, you know, like don't.
Don't help.
So like, and I didn't, you know, it's a great warning because you suddenly, you want to do it the whole time. And one lady did it. One lady shouted out one line and the whole production stopped and they all did the shame thing with the finger. It's really embarrassing for her.
Nice.
But it was so much fun. And, you know, I've seen like the Roadhouse, the musical, and some other ones. They're a hoot. So if you've got an improv folks in your neck of the woods that put these things on, they tend to be really good.
All right. I live outside of Chicago. So as you've been talking, Googling.
You've got plenty of improv out there, right?
I don't see a Die Hard the Musical this year. Apparently it was at the Auditorium Theater last year. bummer. But first off, if you happen to be in the Portland, Oregon area and can support the Funhouse Lounge, which Daniel has been talking about here, please do that. But if you are not in Portland, Oregon, and you live in some place that cannot supply you with live Die Hard the Musical to support, apparently YouTube has from 2020 the entire, or at least a performance of the entire thing.
Oh, wow. All
streamable.
Right.
Yeah, it's the first hit when you look under videos. It's an hour and 39 minutes. So, yeah, you and some loved ones, I guess. And then you could shout out the lines and not get shamed.
It's true. Yeah.
I will throw out one of my favorite memes comes out this time of year, and it's this. The thing is, Die Hard wasn't a Christmas movie originally. The script was changed by Constantine in 336 to align it with the Sol Invictus Festival, which there's a reply. It was declared a Christmas movie at the Council of Nicaea. I can't believe I have to get angry about this again.
We're probably this is going to be airing this episode's going to be going live the week after Thanksgiving, and usually it's right after Thanksgiving that we start pulling out holiday decorations at Shea Townsend, so I'll be somewhere midstream and putting them up by the time this goes live. But among the holiday decorations is my Hans Gruber Nakatomi Tower falling down advent calendar.
What? That's awesome.
So if you go to Etsy and just search for Hans Gruber Nakatomi Tower, like advent calendar, there are so many people who make it in lots of different designs. You can get it in wood or acrylic or painted or not. I'm just saying, you could support some local weirdo who is not a local weirdo.
They gave out t-shirts that say Nakatomi Christmas Party 1988, and then there's like blood stain on one side. Oh.
I gave a similar shirt to my son years ago that doesn't have the blood stain, but it's got like an authentic looking, like ugly sweater type Nakatomi Plaza Christmas Party 19 whatever for it, but it says it's a blast underneath it.
I have a machine gun ho 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 shirt, you know, like that would be pretty fun to go around in. But
that's
anyway,
amazing.
Yes, well, you know, getting in the holiday spirits, you know, with Die Hard is always important every
so
year.
I just, before you go, Tracy, I'm going to throw out a secondary pick, kind of, sort of, that I saw. It's not Die Hard related, but when you guys started talking about the shirts and stuff, it just reminded me, like, my company that I work for has the ugly Christmas sweater contest every year. And I saw something that I thought was really cool. It's an ugly Christmas tie. And I don't normally wear ties. I don't like ties. But this one is, it's a Christmas tie. But when you put it on, it's basically, there's a cat hanging from your neck is this tie.
Oh, nice.
And I'll have to find it online. I saw it on Instagram. But yeah, so that's that. Anyway, Tracy, what's your pick this week?
So my pick is nowhere near that irreverent and delightful, alas, alas. Although it does feel like kind of timely, especially given your background in technology, Daniel. I've been reading Cory Doctorow's newest in Shitification, which for those of you who are less online than I am, first, good job. Stay that way. But Cory Doctorow, who is a technologist and a kind of media critic and social critic and also science fiction author, coined a term a number of years ago that gets trotted around quite a bit on the interwebs, referring to the way that things don't work very well anymore in the online environment. He referred to it as enshittification, as like this deliberate act of changing technology, largely corporate available technology, so that it becomes less functional, less usable, less user-friendly, and ultimately more friendly to whatever the objectives of corporate entities and their various shareholders are. So in Enshittification, subtitle, Why Everything Suddenly Got Worse and What to Do About It, Doctorow's approach is really interesting. He has the whole book set up as a kind of like medical triage of the internet and its various services. So it starts with like a natural history case study of, we got one of Facebook, we got a chapter on Amazon, we got one on iPhone, and we got one on Twitter, like kind of our big offenders here, yeah? And then we have a whole section on pathology, like what is actually wrong now because of these entities and entities like them. The epidemiology that kind of breaks down all the different ways that technologies become intrusive and less functional and so on. And then finally, like actual treatments, like the cure section. And so if you're the sort of person who finds yourself frustrated by the environment of technology, I know Patrick and I have talked a lot about how does one even use social media to find and build audience anymore in this kind of like totally disaggregated diaspora of nonsense and politicization and toxicity that's out there. If you're the sort of person who thinks about that a lot and is bothered by it a lot and wants to do more than just be mad about it, Cory Doctorow's Enshittification is a really good read.
I will throw it out there that one of the things that is killing me is that new cars. So cars have features now like heated seats and you can hook your phone up to it and you can have some version of CarPlay, I think is what it's called, where you can be listening to an audiobook from your phone on your car's speaker system. You can have navigation, right? Yeah. You can have all these different things. And car manufacturers realized that those are premium things that people were paying for. And so what some of them have done now is they have made those things subscription-based.
God.
So like your remote start on your car is a subscription-based thing now for some manufacturers. Even though it's built into your car, you can't use it unless you pay them a subscription fee.
Well, software went that way and it drives me crazy now that I'm paying – I'm buying software every year. And then – the other thing is they're trying to take all your data so they can feed their LLMs. And so like now your car is also going to have a camera on you, you know, like in the inside just spying on you. And Windows 11, like, come on, how am I even going to use this? If it's going to suck every piece of data that I write, they should be paying me, right? How are they going to sell me something whenever they're just going to turn me into the product? I mean, I'm thinking I'm going to have to get like the Steam OS to play video games on.
And Steam has the new, they're having their new Steam Deck and stuff coming out, right? They're going to have the box that sits next to your TV where you can play video games from Steam on your TV as if it's a console.
Yeah. I mean, that's what you have to do, I guess, at this point.
But the problem is your TV now is also tracking everything you do, because my TV just came up and it popped up with the thing and it's like, hey, we've changed our terms of service and we're now going to, like, everything you do on the TV, we're going to tell people, we're going to sell it to them.
Yeah. It's really interesting because I teach in a high school, and so that means I spend a lot of my time around teenagers, and I have a couple of teenagers in my life as my kids, and I'm seeing more and more teenagers turning away from cloud-based, subscription-based, streaming-based services and getting more and more desirous of physical media. Yeah. Like, it's no longer... Like it, and not just in like kind of like a, oh, I'm going to get this on vinyl for like a collector's urge or as like some kind of like retroflex or something, but like sincerely because they want to actually own things that can't be taken away from them later.
Yeah.
And that's kind of a crazy thing to say out loud and think about, like that we don't actually own the things that we're paying for very much anymore.
I went to the Blast Blockbuster, which is in Bend, Oregon.
Oh, yeah.
And they had all the best VHS tapes, like all the good. I mean, obviously, like old Star Wars and stuff like that, but old science fiction, old Terminator, RoboCop, Aliens. Like, I got all of it for $2 each on VHS. Yeah. And like, I have an old VHS player. If you see one at the thrift store, you should buy it immediately because they're harder and harder to get. Mm-hmm. And they cost more and more on eBay and stuff. But if you got a VHS player, it's like, I love it. Like, this is great. I own this bad boy. I'm going to wait on it to rewind. And then I'm going to fast forward to the commercial at the beginning and then watch it. You know, it's great.
Yeah.
I will say on my MacBook Pro, I bought like the last version of Microsoft Office that you could buy. Right. And I want to say it's like Office for Mac 2013,
yeah.
I think is what it is. And it's gone all the way up and like it can't be updated anymore.
Sure.
But it prompts, you can't get rid of the update prompt. It prompts every time you open something. It's like, hey, update. And the thing is, if you update it, it will remove it from your hard drive and it'll push you to the subscription service.
Wow.
And so that's what I'm not doing. So I deal with this stupid prompt every single time I open something on Office on my Mac where it's like, you need to update. And then I just force quit it. And then inside each app, so Excel, Word, whatever, it's got a strip at the top. It's like, you need to update. And you close that. You still can't type anything. Mm-hmm. You have to like give it like 5 seconds or something before it'll let you start typing things again because it's trying to be as annoying as possible. It resigns itself
to your stubbornness.
Oh my God.
Yeah, to get you. And that's one of the reasons why when I took this MacBook Pro in to get some stuff fixed, I did not want them updating the operating system. So I was worried that it wasn't going to work anymore. And they fucking did it anyway. And then it didn't fucking work. And I was pissed. And then it just turned out that I had to log in so that it got the right key and stuff on it and then it started working again. But yeah, it's just stupid. Yeah. I hate it all. Just give me the disk. And then the problem is like, especially if you're a Mac user, there's no drive. There's no disk drive anymore. Like Windows still has them, but you're talking about Windows 11. Like if you have Windows 11 on a desktop, it thinks it's a laptop. It still like it has all the shit for battery optimization on it. And it's like, but there's no battery. This is not a laptop, you know. And now it's got Copilot everywhere. Yeah,
look, it's aspirationally. It knows what it wants.
Just got to eventually get replaced by something better. I mean, that's the market, right? I mean, it's got to happen at some point. I feel that the AI is just a whole new wave on top of all of this that's going to make everything even crazier.
Crazy. And now they're saying it's possible we're heading towards an AI bubble that's about to burst.
Yeah. Oh, I think that's pretty clear.
Yeah.
Well, because we've got NVIDIA is at the center of all of this sort of like at risk of being like really, really earning our adult rating here. It's kind of a giant economic circle jerk that we've got going on between Apple and NVIDIA and OpenAI and all of them, where they're just kind of passing money and chips and whatnot on along to one another. Like they're swapping pieces of their lunches in third grade or something. So
I like that technical term. That's really
– Yeah, it's really – yeah. It's precise. I've thought about it carefully.
Yeah.
All right. So we've been through good things. I ruined everything by bringing up how things are shitty. The least that we can do is compensate the readers, good Lord Townsend, the listeners, by reminding them of where they can find you and your super cool stuff, Daniel.
Oh, thank you. So my website is danielhwilson.com. I'm not so good about the social media anymore. I'm on Newsguy. I'm on Insta. But I'm not really, you know. If you want to email me, I have an email address that's on my website. All my books are listed on the website. You know, from Robopocalypse, the Andromeda evolution to Hole in the Sky, which I'm very excited about. And yeah, you can find that there. If you have complaints, email me. I'm there. But don't tell me that you can't smell carbon monoxide. I meant to write exhaust. And don't explain the difference between paddling and rowing. I've already heard that, and now I know.
Calm down, people. Just calm down. It's a book.
It's okay. I love it when people read close. I read close, too. So yeah, DanielHWilson.com. That's the place to go.
Fantastic. Well, thank you for being with us, Daniel.
This was a hoot. Thank you.
Hey, thanks for listening to this episode of The Functional Nerds. We really appreciate it. If you liked this episode, or really any of our episodes, please consider backing us over at patreon.com/functionalnerds. You can get access to some cool stuff and help us to keep the lights on. You can also show your support by mentioning us and sharing any of our episodes on your own social channels to help boost the signal. Trust me, that can be huge.
Mr. Carpiers.
You got it right. How about that?
Yeah.
You can call me Cannoli Joe.
Hello, Cannoli Joe.
If you've never listened to the podcast, there's two different styles here. There's Tracy, who does prep work and comes up with some very thoughtful questions. And then, oh, squirrel.
Oh, for God's sake, Patrick Louise.
Hello, Patrick. It is I, Clayface.
Okay. That's probably a good enough signal.
When someone comes up to me and says, "Hey, I really love what you do," I'm like, "I'm sorry. Do you know who I like? I think you have me confused with someone else."
The whiz bang and the gosh wow and the sense of wonder stuff.
My favorite thing about time travel is I actually had a time travel joke for you guys, but you didn't like it.
I'm so excited.